Presents the Tom Hartman Program, your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. A lot of the news, probably tragically at the top of the news, after the disastrous hurricanes in the Midwest, the states and areas would like to clean up. I mean, it seems like a fine idea, and the efforts are being hindered by the fact that so many of the trucks and other equipment, not to mention the people who could be doing that work, are in Iraq. So anyway, we will get to that and many other things going on in the news today as we continue throughout the 3 hours of our program this morning, or this afternoon, as wherever you may be located. First, however, the ongoing story of the American middle class and the corporations involved therewith. Workers are, Paul Krugman writing recently, workers are producing more, but they aren't getting paid more. Corporate profits more than doubled since 2000. Profits as a share of national income were at the highest level ever recorded. And yet, at the same time, one in eight Americans now lives in poverty. Millions of Americans will spend at least 1 year in poverty at some point in their life. One-third of all Americans will live in a state of poverty for 1 year within a 13-year period, any 13-year period recently. Poverty in the United States is higher than in any other developed country, and inequality in the United States has reached record highs. In the midst of this is the conservative philosophy first advanced by Ronald Reagan, or first actually put into law by Ronald Reagan to a large extent in many ways, that what a corporation does is its own damn business and the government should keep its nose out of it and, you know, cut the taxes and do away with the regulation and back off and let companies go ahead. My suggestion is that companies, in exchange for the limited liability that they have, and in exchange for their use of the commons, our court system, which they use to enforce contracts, our money system so that they have a stable medium of exchange, the infrastructure of an educated workforce and so on, have a certain obligation, a certain social responsibility to help establish and build a middle class in the United States. Aaron Brook with the Ayn Rand Institute, AYNRAND.org. Ayn Rand, the author of The Fountainhead and perhaps most significantly Atlas Shrugged, the one of the early and original thinkers of what has become, in some ways, has become the objectivist movement and also the libertarian movement and the modern strain of the conservative movement, although I know Yaron would disavow any of those, but this is the fountainhead, so to speak, the source of the thinking. Yaron, welcome to the program.
Thanks, and I wouldn't disavow the objectivist movement. I'm it, so.
Yeah, okay, well, yeah but all the rest of them are insufficiently pure for
absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and so this question, and I think this really was the question at the core of the so-called Reagan Revolution, and we've been living with this for 26 years now, and it's brought us back to what we saw just before the Republican Great Depression in the late 20s and early 30s, and that's massive inequality. Don't companies have a social responsibility in exchange for limited liability, in exchange for their use of the commons, to help build a middle class in America?
Absolutely. I mean, it is leaving corporations alone that actually succeeds in building a middle class. To the extent that the middle class is suffering today, it is primarily a consequence of overburdensome taxation, overburdensome regulation that the government imposes on them. And I don't believe in this idea of the Reagan Revolution. What I would like is to go to the pre-FDR revolution, to go back to the real individualism and capitalism that was the origins of this country that really created the middle class during the 19th century and the 20th century, pre the burdensome regulations on corporations that FDR passed in the 1930s, which are responsible for much of the distortions in the markets today.
You realize in the census of 1901, the average income among workers in the United States in today's dollars inflation-adjusted dollars, was $9,700. That we had rampant, massive poverty in the United States that led to the rise of the Wobblies, the progressive movement, the populist movement, that propelled Teddy Roosevelt, the Republican, to totally change his policy on things, that ultimately, you know, swung back after in 1918 back to this conservative era, back to the robber barons, but then led directly to Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, these are the robber barons that created every industry and every material good that we have out there today.
I would submit to you their workers created it.
No, the workers are a dime a dozen. They were then and they are today. They're plentiful workers.
Well, that's what conservatives want.
It is minds that create wealth. It is not hands. That's Marxist nonsense. It is ingenuity.
No, it's actually David Ricardo's nonsense.
It's ingenuity.
Ricardo was wrong.
Ricardo was wrong, as was Adam Smith in this regard. It is ingenuity, entrepreneurship. It is engineering and science. It is the human mind that creates wealth, not muscle power. And indeed, during eras in which we free up the human mind, like in the 1920s, like in the 19th century, like in the early part of this century, we get booms. And during times where we try to restrain it through government regulations, taxation, limits on free trade, we get busts. That's the Great Depression. That's the 1970s. That's all the bad periods in American economic history are consequences of government regulation and government intervention in the economy.
You realize you're arguing for an elite of...
Absolutely not.
An intellectual elite. You're saying that people who earn their money by their brains should
be allowed to keep it.
Paid differently or taxed differently than people
who earn their income
by their brawn.
They should be paid exactly the same way through supply and demand in the free market. They should be paid based on the level of their productivity. And indeed, it is the 19th century where the middle class was created. It is the 19th century where the upper class was created. Where did the rich come from? Where was Rockefeller before he became rich? He was a poor young kid. Where was Carnegie? Where was Morgan? All these people started out poor and became rich because of the benefits of capitalism, and the entire middle class. There was no middle class before capitalism. There was, even Marx admits that. There was no middle class before the 19th century with corporations and individuals.
There was a huge middle class in the United States. It was just mostly agricultural. It was called a small family farm.
Well, that's true, but to the extent that the 40% who weren't agricultural were living in cities, that's where the middle class was created. The middle class was created not through social programs. The middle class was created through hard work. Work for whom? Work for the entrepreneurs, the corporations, the industrialists, the so-called robber barons who created this country.
So let me see if I understand, Yaron, what you're saying, and tell me if I'm misunderstanding this, please. You're suggesting that we are in agreement that a corporation has, as a result of their use of the commons and their limited liability in exchange for those things, that they have an obligation to help establish a middle class and advance the ideas of democracy in this country.
No.
You believe that that's best done by government saying, okay, you guys do whatever you want, we're going to keep our hands off. And I believe that's best done by government saying, we have the Sherman Antitrust Act, you can't reach a certain size where you're toxic, you have to pay minimum wages, you have to offer certain benefits, these kinds of things.
No, that's not what I believe. I believe that the outcome is the creation of middle class. I do not believe the corporation has any responsibility to create such a middle class. Corporation, limited liability is just an agreement between shareholders and creditors. Nobody has to lend a company money.
No, it's enforced by law.
It's protected by law, but it's an implicit contract anyway. Nobody has to lend a corporation. I don't pay for
it. Wait a minute. It's a contract between we the people and the corporation.
No,
we the people are saying to a corporation, when I create a corporation, that corporation does not have the liability that I have as a sole proprietor.
That's something that
we the people have given to a corporation.
True. All we the people have done is recognize the contractual fact. The only people who pay a cost, supposedly, for limited liability are its creditors. If you're a creditor, if you don't want limited liability, don't lend the money.
It's not just the creditors, because if a corporation commits a crime, its stockholders and its directors very often, its stockholders cannot be, and its directors very often are not held responsible because of limited liability. So society pays a price for it as well.
Both directors, managers, and large shareholders can, if if they show that they influence control over the company, can be held responsible. The fact is that this is just, this is not some creation of the state. And the use of the commons,
it is,
well, the use of the
state.
Commons is nonsense. I mean, indeed, corporations pay taxes for creating the highways and the educational system and so on that we all benefit from. We all benefit from that, and I'm for privatizing all that. I'm for getting rid of the commons and creating a private education, private roads, private everything, and let's get rid of this argument of the commons. Let corporations run our highways. They'd be much better off, the highways would be.
You and Grover Norquist. So you're suggesting that pure unrestrained corporations will give us a middle class. What is going to cause a corporation to want to pay a middle class wage when if we have a world where essentially there's no borders and there's unlimited labor, 6 billion people on the planet, they can pay 25 cents an hour?
Well, because they can't. The fact is that to get productivity, to get high-quality people, you have to pay for it, and corporations know that. That's the way they make money. They make money by paying people good wages or appropriate wages for their productivity. Profits get driven down in a free market, not up.
AynRand.org, AynRand.org is Yaron Brooks' website, the executive director of the Ayn Rand Institute. Yaron, thanks so much for being with us today.
Good talking to you.
Good talking to you. 16 minutes past the hour.
We're listening to the Tom Hartman Program, the No Boring Zone, on Air America Radio. Call Tom at
866-303-2270. Have you seen the little biggies crawling in the dirt? And for all the little biggies, life is getting worse. Always having dirt to play around in.
The little piggies, that would be us. But look out for the bigger piggies.
Have you seen the bigger piggies in the starch white shed? You will find the bigger piggies stirring up the dirt. Always have clean shirts to play around in.
21 minutes past the hour, Doug Steenland, the chief executive of Northwest Airlines, who received $26.6 million as his company steps out of bankruptcy court. 400 of the airline's top managers. That represents 9% of the compensation in the form of stock. 13.6 million shares, new shares of stock being granted to the 400 top managers at the airline, at Northwest Airlines. And the pilots union looking at this going, hey, wait a minute, we just gave you guys, we just cut our pay and we cut our benefits to help bring this airline out of bankruptcy, and you want to give this one guy $26.6 million, and that's a little less than 10%, so we're talking about $280 million in compensation to the 400 guys who wear white shirts and ties to work every day. We're not sure that this is quite fair. We're not sure that we're, you know, quite all that enthusiastic about this, is, you know, essentially the, you know, what the pilots union is saying at Northwest, and which raises the question. In exchange for the right to do business in this country, in exchange for limited liability, we had probably one of the more famous cases. I wrote about it in my book on equal protection some years ago. And I think the case still stands. There was a meatpacking company out in the Midwest. And the meatpacking company had reinstalled an air conditioning unit that was installed wrong. And it had listeria, which is a bacteria that can kill you. It typically just causes, you know, massive and uncontrolled diarrhea. But in vulnerable populations, in young people, in elderly people, in people with compromised immune systems, and even the occasional healthy person, it'll kill them. And water contaminated with this bacteria was dripping out of the air conditioning system onto the assembly line, onto the hot dogs and other packaged meats. And the company had a detector, which was required by law at the end of the line, looking for bacteria. And the detector started going, bacteria, 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 bacteria. And the people running the factory turned off the alarm because it was too obnoxious. It was making too much noise. And people around the country started dying. And when the people at the factory figured out that they were shipping this stuff out, they didn't say anything. And it took the Centers for Disease Control to do a DNA test on meat that was found in people's freezers, where they had only eaten part of it, and they showed up and ended up at the hospital, but they still had some of the meat left, to do a DNA test to find which particular weird little variant strain of Listeria it was, to find out that all these people had eaten meat from the same packing company, and looking at the lot numbers from the same packing plant from the same time. They showed up at the packing plant, and sure enough, there the detectors turned off. Over 100 people, as I recall, or close to 100 people, died. Now, if somebody was to go out with a gun and kill 100 people, they would get the death penalty in most states, in those states that authorize the death penalty. But this corporation got a fine, a small fine, and that was it, by and large. So in exchange for that limited liability that we give corporations and their senior officers, do they owe us something back, like helping to make a middle class? Or should we go down the road in the United States, as the grower and orchestra of the world is suggesting, that in many ways China is going down? For example, this Jonathan Hari writing in The Independent in the UK, the headline, "We shop until Chinese workers drop." The subhead, "She was expected to work 360 days a year from 7:30 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. with one half-hour break." They're talking about a woman by the name of Wei Marianne. She was expected to work 360 days a year from 7 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. with a half-hour break for lunch and fines for taking too long at the toilet. As in many Chinese factories, military drills were often yelled, "Long live the company." If anyone argued back to the managers, they could be punched in the face. One day, Marianne had a family crisis at home, but she was forbidden by her bosses from going to take care of it. She became angry. She fainted. She forced herself to keep working for the next 2 weeks, but eventually she became so exhausted she collapsed and died before she reached the hospital. The autopsy indicated Gagliosi, heart and organ failure caused by extreme exhaustion. Every month in China, 50,000 fingers are sliced off. This, you know, well, as Yaron said, labor is a dime a dozen. So, you know, this is what you have with unrestrained capitalism. Groups representing Western corporations, now there is an effort in China to allow unions and to actually have in place things like our OSHA laws. And according to this article in the Independent, groups representing Western corporations with factories in China sent armies of lobbyists to Beijing to cajole and threaten the dictatorship into abandoning these new workers' protections. The American Chamber of Commerce, representing Microsoft, Nike, Ford, Dell, and others, listed 42 pages of objections, saying that the new laws were unaffordable and dangerous. 27 minutes past
the Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2020. This is Air America Radio.
Take this job and shove it.
You know, back when, was that Lefty Frizzell? I don't remember who, I believe. Back in any case, back when that song came out, you could say that and always know that there was another good job down the road where you could, you know, be manufacturing something and earn enough money that you could raise a family. And those times are sadly, largely gone. Welcome back. 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you on listener-supported radio, where you support our program by supporting our sponsors. The sponsors of your local program, your local station, rather, as well as our national sponsors like Sacred Grounds Coffee, sacredgroundscoffee.com, Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MAX, 511-MACS, and the Organic Wine Company, 1-888-ECO-WINE, E-C-O-W-I-N-E. 1 year. 1 year is the amount of time it took from the time that Bill Clinton issued an executive order when he first became president, after campaigning on a promise that we will, that he would become the president of, quote, an America that will not coddle dictators from Beijing to Baghdad, end of quote. He issued an executive order soon after becoming president that trade with China could only grow if China, this is from this article in the Independent, that trade with China could only grow if China, in tandem, increased its respect for human rights. Enraged business executives subjected him to nuclear-strength lobbying, so Clinton ditched his executive order after 1 year. Now corporations that claim they would bring freedom and democracy to China are, in fact, lobbying to crush freedom and opposing the plain democratic will of the Chinese people. As James Mann, the former L.A. Times bureau chief in Beijing, put it after years of observing the behavior of big business in China, he said, the business communities of China and the United States do not harbor dreams of democracy. Both profit from a Chinese system that permits no political opposition, or both are content with it. And by the way, their lobbying seems to have paid off. The unelected Chinese National People's Congress is due to vote on the new labor laws in the next month or so, but the proposals have already been massively watered down. Western corporations explicitly seeking a China where a tiny number of extremely rich people are free to organize, that is, form corporations, but the vast majority of poor people are physically prevented so in the form of unions and labor laws and things by the state. This, a laissez-faire paradise. Tim in Portland, Oregon. Hey, Tim, welcome to the program.
Morning, Tom, or afternoon, or morning to me and you. I love it when you have guests on that illuminate, like, the reality. I mean, that's a really challenging conversation you had, but ultimately what the objectivists never talk about is that they know deep inside at a fundamental level that there will be far fewer captains of industry than people that will produce the goods. They know that their system will produce what you say, what you challenge them on, the elite. It's the way that it works. I mean, if everybody was as physically as motivated as they were, they wouldn't have anybody to produce the goods. If the individualistic society worked as well as they said it would, everybody would have a mansion.
Right. And that's where it doesn't work. I mean, there has never successfully been a nation or a society or an economy, frankly, organized along libertarian objectives, conservative policies that has worked. I mean, we're seeing the after 26 years of conservative rule in the United States, economically anyway, by and large, we're seeing the logical consequences, the disaster, the failure, the absolute failure of conservative principles in the United States. Gary in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Hey, Gary.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is a subject very dear to my heart. I submit we need another leader, president, if you will, that will have the philosophy in this subject that Franklin Delano Roosevelt had, that three things: too much is given, much is expected, that greed, enriched greed rules us all right now, and we need to restore the middle class and sustain it. I believe, maybe you can elaborate on it, in his speech in 1935, this was his philosophy.
Oh, it wasn't just his philosophy. I mean, yeah.
Greed, and we can't go on like this. I think that's the thing.
Yeah, well said, Gary, and I debated three conservatives at the Jewish University in Los Angeles yesterday, and Dennis Prager, one of them, made the point, the same point that Limbaugh makes.
Roosevelt is dead. His policies may live on, but we're in the process of doing something about that as well.
And, yeah, he is dead. And I said, no, we're trying to get out a bicycle pump and revive him. I was making a joke. But I really believe that the future of this country depends on not just leaders who understand, who get it economically, but a populace that gets it economically. And that's what we're not getting, in large part because of Reagan's suspension of the Sherman Act in 82, his suspension of the Fairness Doctrine in 86, and in Clinton signing the Telecommunications Act in 96. Combined with this constant drumbeat in the media of the wonders of the so-called free market, when in fact there is no such thing as a free market. Markets are created by we the people, by government. So, you know, it's a very strange thing. Marianne in Queens, New York. Hey, Marianne.
Hi, Tom. How are you? You know, your guest was describing, and he, first of all, he said get rid of the commons, which it seems that that's what's happening. I mean, these corporations are really have completely taken over, and we have not exerted our rights at all. It seems like we've been sleepwalking through life and allowed this to happen.
Sleepwalking Through History was the title of Haynes Johnson, the Pulitzer Prize winner's brilliant biography of the Reagan years, and it's a good description.
And, you know, this description I've heard more than once of private streets, I mean, we'll have ghettos then. I mean, there'll be some streets that certain people can go on and other people will be in ghettos. And I mean,
we're already moving that way. We have gated communities.
Right, and it's very scary, and people should be constantly on the phone and writing to Congress, and beyond that, I'd like to know what we can do. I mean, Dick Durbin was talking about, you know, legislation or to have publicly funded elections and to take back the airwaves, you know, take back the media, and I don't know what people can do to support that, but I think we better do something.
Well, I think that what Dick Durbin points out, what Bernie Sanders, what many other progressive members of Congress, and frankly some conservatives as well, point out is that publicly funded elections is a great, you know, the conservatives don't want the labor unions involved, people on our side don't want the corporations involved, you know, but publicly funded elections work, and they work very well. They work here very well in Portland. It's a growing movement and quite effective in Arizona and in Maine. It happens in a lot of other countries. In some countries they have, like in England and the United Kingdom, you know, the cap. You can't spend more than £100,000 on an election. The problem with that is that it runs afoul of our First Amendment. They don't have that in the UK. But I think publicly funded elections, A, instant runoff voting, B, so that you can get more than just two viewpoints in. And because that's really the only way to correct the problem that we have of this two-party system that we inherited, or that was created by the founders, because it was before John Stuart Mill came up with the idea of proportional representation. That was 1860-1861, as I recall, when he first wrote his treatise on that. But getting involved and letting your politicians know that you'd like to see the corruption of money out of politics, step one. And once the corruption of big money is out of politics, then I think we'll see things moving in a more appropriate and positive direction. Will in South Park, Colorado. Hey, Will.
Ruth Teller, how you been, man?
I'm great, but I'll get better, Will.
I just wanted to see if maybe now we're all in agreement that Nazi-like fascist isn't way out of line and I shouldn't be flogged.
I wouldn't say Nazi-like, because the Nazis weren't fascists. The Nazis were a death cult. They were a bizarre offshoot of a synthesis of Christianity and pseudo neo paganism or something.
And they
gave fascists a bad name. The real fascists were Mussolini and Franco, frankly.
The combination between those two describes George W. Bush and his friends.
Well, you know, if you define fascism as the merger of corporations and states, then that's certainly something that we're seeing in the United States right now. But at the same time, it's very important to keep pointing out that is not what Hitler was about. Hitler was not a fascist. He was a mass murderer. He was a maniac. He was a religious fundamentalist in his own bizarre way, using that to justify mass murder. Andy in Jamestown, New York. Hey, Andy.
Hey, Tom, how you doing?
Fine. What's up?
I got a couple points. One, this guy that you had on, I don't know where you got him, from the basement or something.
These are thoughtful people, Andy. I mean, I disagree with Yaron, but they really believe that if their policy is executed, we'll have a better world. They really and truly do.
He said that he wanted corporations to, you know, take over everything and they pay taxes. Well, most of the corporations I know are off-seas. They're offshore, so they're not paying taxes, first of all.
Halliburton, you moving to Dubai? Yeah. Oh, Andy, it sounds like Andy's line just croaked. So, but, Andy, I get your point. And Kellogg Brown and Root, the division of Halliburton that's been getting all these bucks from us for their work in Iraq and Afghanistan and Katrina and everything else, every opportunity the Bush administration had to shovel money at the company that Dick Cheney's such a huge stockholder in, moving to the Middle East. It's like, let's say, what? Yeah, and a lot of corporations paying very, very little for the commons that they're using. And I'm not anti-corporate. I've started 7 corporations in my life, and I run one. Let's just do it right. 45 minutes.
You're tuned in to the Tom Hartman Program. Fair and slightly unbalanced. This is Air America Radio.
More of us working for the man. Interesting, over the weekend, one of the articles I saw in the Los Angeles Times, eating breakfast and reading the paper, an article about foreclosures in the neighborhoods where the houses had values of over $1 million. People who had just refied to the point where they were wiped out, or not even that. You know, they just, you know, bought too much house or didn't realize that the adjustable rate mortgages actually do adjust. Or they were expecting that they'd get a raise and they never got it, or they, you know, their job went to India or whatever. On and on it goes. And sometimes it just gets, you know, downright strange. I mean, just absolutely downright strange. Here we have this Dateline Vienna, Austria, in a case that could set a global legal precedent for granting basic rights to apes. Animal rights advocates are seeking to get the 26-year-old male chimpanzee by the name of Heisel, legally declared a person. Our main argument is that he's a person and has basic legal rights, said Eberhard Thauer, a lawyer leading the challenge on behalf of the Association Against our Animal Factories, the Vienna Animal Rights Group. We mean the right to life, the right not to be tortured, the right to freedom under certain conditions. We're not talking about the right to vote here. Well, you know, what's interesting about this, first of all, is I'm a big supporter of animal rights. In fact, I was a speaker at, I think it was the very first meeting PETA ever had, back when, as I recall, his name was Alex Pacheco, the guy who was one of the original founders, was there. This must have been it was in the late 70s, whenever it was. They're at the beginning, maybe. I mean, maybe they'd been around for a while before that. But in any case, it was a big deal meeting. You know, maybe 60 people showed up. I am an advocate of animal rights. And what I find bizarre here is that we're having a conversation about whether a chimp should have legal rights under the law, and I believe that they should have a wide variety of protections, frankly. And yet nobody is talking about whether corporations should have the rights of, particularly and specifically, the rights of personhood, of humans. In the United States right now, corporations enjoy Fourth Amendment rights of privacy, even though they claim that when you come to work, you have no right of privacy. They claim the right of privacy. And so they can watch your keystrokes. They can monitor you over your shoulder with a camera system. They can monitor that you read your emails. They can listen to your telephone conversations. They can invade your body and demand bodily fluids from you and analyze them for a whole variety of things, legal as well as illegal. Yet they claim that they have privacy, Fourth Amendment rights of privacy, that they have Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination. They don't have to tell people that asbestos will kill them or tobacco will kill them. I mean, for a long, long time they tried that. They obviously claim Sixth, Seventh, and Eighth Amendment rights to due process, legal due process, 14th Amendment rights of equal protection under the law. So if you're trying to keep a Walmart out of the community, it's the same thing as if you're saying that a person can't sit at a lunch counter because their skin's the wrong color. I mean, this doctrine of corporate personhood. I have a bumper sticker on my car. It's been there for years, that I got from I think it was through CellDef, that says that abolish corporate personhood. And no, it's from WILF, the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. WILPF.org is the website. Abolish corporate personhood. And one of the big embraces of corporate personhood, obviously this began in the 1860s, but one of the big embraces of it began in the Reagan administration in the 1980s. Oh, we shouldn't have the Sherman Antitrust Act. I mean, we have it still in the books, but we shouldn't enforce it because, you know, corporations, they should have more rights and we should just let them alone. And Reagan mentioned 35 times during the Republican so-called debate. Bush mentioned once, and then there was the conspicuous sound of crickets, as Bill Maher so brilliantly pointed out Friday night. But Reagan was the guy who brought us the federal debt. Sherry Miner, writing over at Common Dreams, brought us the federal debt that Clinton had to eliminate. He dismantled the Department of Energy that we could use right now. I mean, think of all the various types of research into solar and alternative power over the last 27 years that have been done away with. Reagan taking the solar panels off the White House that Jimmy Carter had put up there. Jimmy Carter declaring that he was going to have 20% of the nation's electricity from solar power by the year 2000, and he actually had the means and the plan to do it. And the funding to do it. Reagan killed the whole thing. His whole Star Wars thing, handing several trillion dollars to his buddies in the defense industry, literally his buddies, the people who helped put him into power. The me generation, which came out of the consequence that greed is good, this whole idea. College graduates declining, the invasion of Grenada, the Iran-Contra affair. And then, you know, some of the folks over at Common Dreams posting into the in response to this original article by Sherry Miner, the Reagan myth. Reagan set race relations back in this country 25 years, turned regulatory hen houses over to the foxes of big business, deregulated CEO greed, backed me-now market thinking. He spurred the middle class and lower classes for his rich pals, stabbed the unions that he said he was going to help, stabbed them in the back, ran to the biggest pork-barrel-fueled U.S. deficit in history, killed Carter's energy policy, negotiated with terrorists, including he gave arms to Saddam and to bin Laden, looked aside as Saddam gassed the Kurds, threw the mentally ill out on the street, bargained with the Iranians to keep our people hostage in 1980 during the election. The savings and loan scandal, a direct result of Reagan's deregulation of that industry, which functioned as a funnel for moving American cash into the taxpayer cash into the hands of Texas developers. Remember the farm crisis? Willie Nelson going around with farm aid, again a result of the policies of the Reagan administration, rescinding the Fairness Doctrine by executive order, no less. The first president to rob Social Security to cover his deficit of giving tax cuts to the poor, or to the rich, rather. I mean, it's just, during his presidency, the U.S. armed, funded, and trained some of the worst killers in the world. This Graham posting over there, and especially in Central America, 80,000 killed in the El Salvador Civil War. 200,000 total from the U.S.-supported 1954 coup. 60,000 in Nicaragua during Reagan's time, mainly by the terrorists we called the Contras. And all Republicans can talk about is how wonderful Reagan was. Let's bring back the free market. 57 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Hartman Program on Air America Radio. Welcome to the Democracy Zone.
Oh, we've been talking about the conservative worldview and this whole conservative vision of we the people having not only no say in how things get done, but not even any commons any longer. Not even necessarily the commons of the government. It's in some ways downright bizarre. And in the news, there is a piece of this, a dimension of this, that I think is very, very often misunderstood, in fact, universally probably, misunderstood and largely overlooked. Today in the Wall Street Journal, for example, an article about Paul Wolfowitz. The headline, Wolfowitz's account of pay package role is disputed. And they talk about how Max Baucus, the Democrat from Montana, is suggesting Wolfowitz should step down. And also yesterday, the board approved a new policy statement on health programs that reaffirmed the World Bank's commitment to family planning programs. The decision came after the U.S. backed away from proposals that would have imposed limits on the programs, which include birth control and abortion services. So Wolfowitz carrying water in the mind of the so-called social conservatives, the largely radical, mostly radical Christians, I would say, who are suggesting no federal money should ever go to fund birth control or instruction, any information, sex education, those kinds of things. And people think that that's what it's all about. That's not what it's all about. David Korten is with us. David, K-O-R-T-E-N, davidkorten.org is his website. He's a 30-year veteran of the foreign aid system. He lived abroad for 21 of those years. He worked with the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, has been a consultant to the World Bank. He's a friend. David and I spent a week together with the Dalai Lama a couple of years ago in Dharamsala. A movie is being made about that. It's going to be coming out this month, in about 3 weeks. It's a premiering in Telluride, Dalai Lama Renaissance, with Harrison Ford. And he's the author of a couple of books that you really need to check out, When Corporations Rule the World, and his most recent, The Great Turning, From Empire to Earth Community. David Korten. David, welcome to the program.
Tom, it's great to be back on the number one progressive talk show in the nation.
Well, thank you, David. Great to have you with us. You're also the chairman of the board of Yes Magazine, which is another great publication. David, you're the guy that I turn to when I don't get this stuff, and there's a lot of stuff that I get, but there's a lot that I don't. And so my question to you, and we had this conversation off the line, a week or so ago, and I was so fascinated by it, I just wanted you to share your thoughts about it with our listeners. What is the World Bank? How did it come into being? Why should any of us give a hoot? I mean, there's all this stuff about Wolfowitz, which seems like it's payback for his role in the Iraq War. And why is the media assiduously not discussing any of the real stuff that the World Bank is doing?
Well, of course, we're talking about the corporate media here, and they're not inclined to criticize institutions that are solidly behind the corporate agenda. The bank history started out, actually even before World War II was over, the policy planners in the United States were trying to figure out how to assure that after World War II that the United States would displace Britain as the leading imperial power in the world. They were very concerned about the consequences of the Great Depression, didn't want to replicate that, and felt that what they needed to do to avoid that was to have control of the world's markets and resources.
Now, these were people, let us know, and unless you disagree with this, these were people who thought that what they were doing was the best thing for world peace and for the United States over the long term.
Well, I think there was a split there between people who were really believed that the United States needed to be bringing prosperity and democracy to the rest of the world, and those who, like George Kennan, who were totally focused on real politic interests of
US
power and control. And that played out as the public image, in contrast to the secret or hidden purpose.
Right.
Now the bank itself was actually originally created to support the reconstruction of Europe. It was originally called the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development. But as it turned out, the Europeans weren't really interested in financing their reconstruction through loans, which was very smart. And the U.S. also developed the Marshall Plan, which was based on grants. And so that totally superseded the bank.
So the bank had to reinvent itself to continue?
Yes, exactly. And so they basically reinvented themselves in terms of making loans to to what we then called underdeveloped countries, or low-income countries. But there again, they ran into resistance because the elites of those countries were divided between those who were economic nationalists and wanted to maintain control over their own economies, were very very leery of foreign entanglements, and of course this was as the colonialism was being dismantled, so there was very good reason for suspicion of foreign entanglements with the rich countries. On the other hand, there were also groups of economic globalists that saw their interests as tied to the essentially to the former colonial powers, and who were quite open to bank borrowing. So the bank undertook a very concerted effort to build its reach and constituency by aligning with the globalist elites, and also by bringing lots of young people from these countries to the United States for economics training and training in the bank, and essentially built up its constituency.
Kind of Chicago school economics. I mean, this is what led to the whole generation of the economic hitmen.
You know, the whole thing is around the idea of global markets, of open markets, foreign financing, the whole neoliberal agenda, the privatization, minimization of public services, and so forth.
Right. Let's do away with the commons. Let's let the corporations handle everything. Aveeno, or whatever the company is, Aveeno, the French company, will own our water. The Enron, were they still around, will own our power, and et cetera, et cetera. David,
yeah.
you mentioned that there are, under Wolfowitz, that really Bush didn't put Wolfowitz in as a friendly favor to a good guy, or as a way of paying him off for helping him have his Iraq war. That really he put Wolfowitz in charge of the World Bank to move forward two very neoconservative agendas.
Yeah, well, yes. Basically, to continue pushing the economic, the neoliberal agenda, and as you were noting earlier, to hinder the family planning programs, and to begin, it's hard to know what the inside was, but the bank is now going through another process of trying to reinvent itself, so far mm-hmm. as I can determine from friends who follow this closely.
The trade facilitation infrastructure and the Paris Declaration. These are meaningless to most people, but can you give us the essence of what this is all about?
Well, you've got to trace a little bit more of the history of the bank, that when the borrowing countries got into a deep debt crisis at the end of the 1970s, partly as a result of previous World Bank loans, but also borrowing to cover the rising prices of energy, they introduced what they called structural adjustment lending, which was lending to countries basically in return for giving over their policy to the bank to impose this neoliberal agenda, which of course had devastating consequences in terms of increasing inequality, environmental devastation,
right.
and so forth. And so the
neoliberal, what we would today in America call a conservative agenda.
Yeah, very much so.
I mean, the world calls it neoliberal, but this is kind of Reaganism writ large.
It is, and it is sometimes referred to as the Washington Consensus because it reflects a set of policies, consensus between the U.S. Treasury Department, the World Bank, and the IMF.
We have less than a minute left, David, just to summarize this.
Yeah, well, okay, as you noted, the Paris Declaration is an effort to for the bank, essentially the bank and the neoliberal forces of the OECD to take back control over the policies of low income countries by consolidating foreign aid all into under one office under UN administration, but run by bank personnel. In a sense, the bank is infiltrating.
Is this helping build a larger factory floor for the multinational corporations, more cheap labor?
Yeah, absolutely. It's all to facilitate the further takeover of every economy
of the world,
global corporate interests.
Yeah. David Korten, David, KORTEN.org, the website. Check it out. In particular, get his new book, The Great Turning, from Empire to Earth Community. Thank you, David.
Thank you.
16 minutes past the hour.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Not be pretty, and my clothes are not the best, and there ain't no big shots in my family tree. But if you're wondering who it was that made this country great, you don't have to look no further, it was me. I'm the man that built the bridges, I'm the man that laid the track, I'm the man that built this country with my shoulders and my back. I'm the man that built the power dams and oiled all the cars, and I laid down the cornerstone for this great land of ours.
Indeed. 21 minutes past the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 718, that's the number of World Bank staffers who have signed a letter expressing concern and calling for a resolution of a crisis involving World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz. But I would submit that the crisis goes way beyond just the issue of what's going on with whether or not Paul Wolfowitz is paying his girlfriend. I mean, all this covers. Isn't it a terrible thing? Paul Wolfowitz's girlfriend is working in the State Department and making more than Condie Rice. Well, yeah, it's a terrible thing. But turning the third world into a factory floor for American and they're not even really arguably American multinational corporations any longer. General Electric does half its business outside the United States. How can you call it an American company? Halliburton is not just reincorporating their CEO and everybody. They're moving to the United Arab Emirates. Just, you know, ahead of the Democratic investigations, in my opinion. So when you talk about the World Bank, it's important to keep in mind what their real job is, which is to advance the interests of these big corporations. I'd like to toss something else into the mix here in our conversation for this hour. I have gotten so many of these emails now. I'm writing to ask your help to join me with an idea to relieve gas prices. I'm tired of having people constantly insist there's nothing they can do. They're like sheep going to the slaughter. There is something we can do. This is from one email. Here's another one. No gas on May 15th. Don't pump gas on May 15th. Mark it on your day planner and your calendar. This is from another one. You know, they go on and on and on. This was originally sent by a retired Coca-Cola executive. Came from one of his engineer buddies who retired from Halliburton. It's worth your consideration. Join the resistance. Don't buy gas for a certain day, the 15th of May. This makes, you know, and going on, you know, as like this. I got to tell you, the gas companies, I mentioned this on the radio a week or so ago, the first time I started getting barraged with these things, and friends of mine are getting them all, and people are calling in going, hey, you know, you got to promote that May 15th, don't buy gas for a day thing. You don't buy gas for a day. You know who's going to get hurt by that? The small independent local retailers. And even they are not going to be really hurt over the long term, because we're not talking about reducing the amount of gasoline we're using. This is not a boycott. It's like a spoiled kid yelling, hey, look at me, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, and the oil companies look and they go, yeah, okay, we see that you're there. And you're still going to have to buy gas, right? If we want to have an impact, not just on the price of gas, but on our dependency on foreign oil, which is really what brought us 9/11. Do you really think that we would have had the first Gulf War defending Kuwait, which was a kingdom, a dictatorship? We defended one dictatorship against another dictatorship. Why? Because the first dictatorship was supplying us with oil. And in Gulf War I, we stationed troops in Saudi Arabia to stage them for attacks against Kuwait, against Saddam's guys in Kuwait. And Osama bin Laden was so incensed by that after he, in his mind, victoriously, with our help, victoriously drove the Russians out of the Soviets out of Afghanistan. He went back home to Iraq and said, okay, now we've got to get these Americans off these Air Force bases in Saudi Arabia because these men are drinking alcohol and looking at pornography, and they're not Muslims, and the women, you go to the Hajj and you're not a Muslim, if they find you, they will kill you. Or they can. The penalty for trying to convert people to Christianity in Saudi Arabia is death. They take this very seriously. And the women on these Air Force bases that Bush Sr. had put there in Saudi Arabia were driving around with their elbows showing, and they were driving cars, and they were drinking alcohol. And I mean, this is just absolutely unacceptable. And Osama bin Laden said, you pull those people out or I'm going to attack you. And we didn't, and he did. And then last year, George Bush did pull them out. So bin Laden got exactly what he wanted. And he's still free and having a good old time. But the bottom line, do you really think that if we hadn't been dependent on oil, that we would be even involving ourselves in that part of the world? You know, those parts of the world, we don't seem to have much interest in what's going on in Namibia, the former Rhodesia, even though millions of people are being killed by Mugabe. It's a tragedy. We frankly should be involved there. But no, they don't have any oil. So, you want to solve the problem. It's not don't buy gas for a day. Then everybody just fills up on Tuesday, right? It's not don't buy gas for a day. It's don't drive for a week. It's like start using public transportation. It's buy a more fuel-efficient car. It's lobby your elected representatives for higher CAFE, corporate average fuel efficiency standards, right across the board from cars manufactured in the United States. If the American car fleet had the same fuel efficiency as the European car fleet right now, we would not need one drop of money of oil from OPEC. 27 minutes past the hour.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
Past the hour. Hey, Friday of this week, join me in San Diego. KLSD AM 1360, our affiliate in San Diego, is putting on a listener party. I'll be doing the show from there. And then later on in the afternoon, from 4 till 8 afternoon, early evening, at the Cosmopolitan Restaurant in San Diego Old Town, we're going to have a party. We'll just hang out with you, our listeners, some folks from the radio station, and I'll be there. And, bring a book and I'll sign it. They may have some for sale there as well. I'm not sure. But it's mostly just get together, say hi. I'm looking forward to it. I'll do a little song and dance for you all, too. So should be a lot of fun. Check it out. 35 minutes past the hour. I just want to say one more time, not buying gas for one day is meaningless. It is absolutely meaningless. The oil companies laugh at us when we do this. I mean, they laugh at us. Changing your lifestyle so that you consume less gasoline and lobbying your politicians, demanding of your politicians accountability so that they will change policy at the level of the federal government so that we will consume less gasoline, that puts the fear of God in the hearts of the oil companies. That will actually change things. And that's why they love it when people get all worked up about, oh, let's not buy any gas on May 15th. I guarantee you, the CEO of ExxonMobil, if he's aware of this, is going, hey, that's cool. That'll keep him from doing anything else. They'll feel like they did something. But nothing will change, and we'll make just as much money. So, anyway. Mark in Los Angeles. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hey,
Hey, you want to know something that's even more ridiculous than not buying gas on one day?
What's that?
Buying this ethanol food-grown fuel, because it basically takes food out of the bellies of people and puts it in their cars instead. I think that's going to just cause more world hunger.
Yeah, well, I know, you know, John Stossel's out there raving about it. The fact of the matter is that right now, to a large extent, a lot of the ethanol produced in the United States from corn is, you know, the efficiency is not all that great. You put in 7/10 of a gallon of gasoline and you get out 1 gallon of ethanol, that kind of thing. But it's a start. And frankly, what we need to do is decriminalize, like Canada did, the growing of hemp, which is very, very efficient at converting sunlight into diesel, into oil that could be used for diesel. And let's go with biodiesel. Or grow some of the other kinds of crops like switchgrass or cane sugar, things like that.
But
down
still,
in Brazil, you know, they're very, you know, virtually, you know, half the auto fleet in Brazil is using alternative fuels, biofuels.
But that takes away from the growth of crops. And in Brazil, they cut down so much of their rainforest to grow this stuff to put in their cars. They're basically cutting off their nose just to keep their tanks full.
I know. And Lula is doing it. And it's interesting you bring that up, because my best friend in New York, who I stayed with over the last couple of days when I was in Manhattan Thursday and Friday night, Jerry Schneiderman, lives part of the year down in Brazil. His wife is a dual national, Brazilian and American, and a professor at State University of New York and down in Brazil. And we were talking about that, and he said, you know, Lula is doing this thing where he's trying to cut the rainforest to save the rainforest. In other words, they're going to have controlled growth. And it's going to be a really tough thing. It's going to be really tricky to see if it can work in a highly corrupt environment. But you do make a good point. And, you know, and the solution, obviously, is better mass transportation, better city planning, no more suburbs that are dependent upon cars, and a modification of the existing suburbs we have, local sources of energy, cars that run on no gasoline at all, but instead are rechargeable electric cars that are rechargeable from your house, which is powered by solar energy, you know, or a community that's powered by wind power. I mean, there's a whole lot of alternatives out there, and I'm all in favor of all of them. But number one, moving us off gasoline has to be a high priority.
May I say one more thing about that World Bank?
Yeah, please.
It's just a subprime lender that wants to foreclose on all the infrastructure around.
That's a really good metaphor. That's a really good metaphor.
Yeah, the World Bank is, backed up by all the smiling bankers in the different major capitals of the world, and they're the ones that hold the paper, and they're the ones that will foreclose on infrastructures that are either mortgaged, such as here, our roads in this country, or infrastructures yet to be built and paid for with down payment and, you know, slave labor and all that kind of stuff.
Absolutely. This is why a lot of countries like Argentina and Ecuador and Brazil, for that matter, are trying to pay off all of their debt to the World Bank and just say, see you guys later. You know, take your what the rest of the real world refers to as neoliberalism, what I refer to as American conservative economics. Take your crazy economic policies and, you know, put them someplace else. Steve, driving in New York. Hey, Steve, what's on your mind today? Steve? No, Steve. Let's go to Tom in Brattleboro, Vermont. Hey, Tom.
Hi. How you doing?
Great. What's up?
Hey, on a couple of occasions in the past, you've discussed the difference in feelings on human behavior by liberals and conservatives. For example,
yes,
you typically say that liberals consider people to be inherently good. Conservatives typically say that people are inherently bad. They need control. I'd like to follow that through, get some more information, and study it. I wonder, can you give me some links?
I just finished writing an entire chapter about this for a book that will be out in the fall called Cracking the Code, The Art and Science of Political Persuasion. You'd probably have to Google around. I mean, it really, Leon Barrett, here's the best source. Leon Barrett wrote a book called Political Ideologies. It's a textbook. It's a college textbook for political science classes, and so it's like $80, but very often you can find a used copy for $3, you know, at abebooks.com or on Amazon or something like that, or any local used bookstore.
What's the name of the book again?
It's called Political Ideologies. by Leon Baradat, spelled just like it sounds, B-A-R-A-D-A-T. He's not the only person who's written about this. I mean, it's been around for literally 300 years. This is a debate that goes back to the original debate between Thomas Hobbes and John Locke. I mean, Hobbes was, you know, pretty much dead by the time Locke was becoming famous, but that's really where it all started. And Jefferson wrote about it. A lot of the founders wrote about it. And it's been around for a long time. But check out Leon Baradat's book, Political Ideologies, if that's the kind of stuff that fascinates you. I find it fascinating. In fact, I had breakfast with my agent in New York on Friday, my book agent. And we were kicking around the idea of writing an entire book about it, because I think it's worth one. But we'll see where we go with it. Robert in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom? I really enjoy your show.
Thank you.
I was calling you about private highways. There's a lot of them in the country.
Yes, and it's growing, and most of them are not owned by American corporations, which means the profits are going overseas. The Spanish company is the largest owner of private highways in the United States.
Anyway, my battery's going dead. I'm going to have to shut up.
I'm sorry, Robert. I know you've been on hold for a while. Up. I think we actually did lose Robert. What a bummer. Just sit on hold that long, and then off it goes. Gene in San Francisco. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi. Tom, you were touching on the lack of corporate ethics, and I have a couple of points I want to add. Sure. First, I think corporations have become the decision makers as to the choice and direction and use of scientific knowledge in our society, but they don't seem willing to apply that knowledge to its fullest.
And the point, here's where your comment intersects with the comment of two callers ago. Because corporations are essentially amoral, and that was a point that Yaron Brook made, with which I agree. Corporations don't have morality. They're not intrinsically evil. They're not intrinsically good.
Mm-hmm.
And, I know that conservatives like to say that people like me think that corporations are evil. I don't. You know, as I said, I own a corporation. This show is a corporation. Is owned by a corporation that I own. I mean, so it's a small business. And the problem is that a corporation's to the extent that a corporation does have morality, its first mission is to generate a profit, whereas humans' first mission is to survive, is to have safety and survival and food and comfort and quality of life. And there's a whole different kind of morality associated with humans. Now, if you assume that a human's first mission is to destroy other people, harm other people, commit war on other people, and be evil, which is what Thomas Hobbes said, that's the conservative worldview, then corporations are morally superior to people, and you would want to have a world where the corporations rule the world, because at least they're amoral, whereas the people are evil. If, on the other hand, like John Locke and Thomas Jefferson and the thinkers of the Enlightenment, you believe that people are intrinsically good, then you would want to have corporations under the thumb and under the control of people, because corporations are morally neutral, but people are morally positive.
Yeah, my point here is that I want to take a real-world example right now.
Sure.
Their actions contradict scientific logic.
But not economic logic.
For example, that poisonous wheat gluten and rice protein that was contaminated that pet food, they then resold it to make animal feed. At most, doing that is only prosecuted as a misdemeanor. So no wonder these corporations compound one poisoning on top of another. They choose not only to avoid scientific cause and effect, but they compound that by avoiding ethics as well.
Right, but Gene, they are paying attention to profit, cause, and effect, and that is their morality. And there's a brilliant piece in today's New York Times, and I almost pulled it out to go off on a riff on it because there's so many examples, and then I thought it's going to be a whole lot of me reading on and on and on. But there's a brilliant piece in today's New York Times about all these people who have died in countries all over the world. It's a follow-up on a piece on Panama a couple of days ago, because diethylene glycol, which is a component of antifreeze, has been, because it's cheap, used to contaminate medication and foods, and just like the melamine that got into the pet food and ultimately into our food, because it's cheap, in order to raise profits out of China. 45 minutes past it.
The Tom Hartman Program. Viagra for your brain. On Air America Radio. Call
866-303-2270. I know that this feeling now feels a surprise.
thousand miles if you'd like an opportunity to see one of the most beautiful parts of Europe. Join us, David Corton, our guest in this hour, is going to be there. Francis Moore LePay, Tom Hayden, George Lakoff, Swami Vyandananda, and others for the Praxis Peace Conference in Dubrovnik, Croatia, June 3rd through the 9th. The title of the conference, Transforming Culture from Empire to Global Community. Louise and I will be there and hanging out with folks, and you know, technology, God's willing, we will be doing this program live from there. You can get all the information on the web at Praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S, praxispeace.org. Ellen Ratner on the line with us from the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen, what's happening in Washington, D.C. today?
It's a slow news day, but I think the most interesting thing is the local ABC television station in Washington crunched some numbers and found out that the Justice Department has not hired one African-American to replace people that left in their civil rights division. In the criminal section, 50 attorneys, they have only two are African American, and Congress said that they are going to launch an investigation about this ASAP. Conyers is on this like you cannot believe.
Well, first of all, there's not a legal requirement. There's not like a quota system or even an affirmative action program, but it seems astoundingly unseemly that the civil rights division would not even hire a single African American when you've got this massive disenfranchisement of African Americans in Ohio and Florida in the elections of 2000 and 2004. Well, actually, now all of a sudden it makes sense.
Well, of course. And
yeah, now we understand.
And one of the deputies hired 14 career attorneys. He made sure that half of them were members of the Federalist Society.
Yeah.
So the hearing, you're right, there's no law that says this, but clearly they can make life uncomfortable. There is also going to be several hearings this week on oversight in Iraq as the House is trying to work out what they're going to do. As I said to you this morning on your show this morning, it looks like some Democrats are going for 2 months, full appropriations for the war with 2 months dependent on congressional approval in July. And it looks like this week, Wednesday, they're going to be hearing from Secretary of Defense Gates, as well as Peter Pace, Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, on appropriations on defense, as well as Veterans Affairs is going to be focusing on benefits for our troops, as well as the Senate Committee on Homeland Security is going to be taking a look at violent Islamic extremism and what can really honestly be done by our government, if anything, to stem that.
Right.
And that's, of course, Lieberman's committee, Lieberman and Collins' committee.
Yeah, and he's speaking out on this issue, and I think rightly so, although I'm concerned about violent religious extremism of other stripes as well. You've got from the Tamil Tigers to Tim McVeigh's. It all right across the board, we need to be saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, violence in the name of religion is antithetical to religion. I'm curious, on Sunday, the front page of the Los Angeles Times had a fascinating story about how Mr. Gates, the Secretary of Defense, is not on the same page as the Bush administration and General Petraeus. Any fallout from this in Washington?
Well, it's unclear as to what the fallout is. I mean, clearly they're not happy with Gates sort of getting this out there, but Gates is clearly getting this out there, and we know that from people in the Pentagon. And people in the Pentagon, many I know who are not pro-war, are very much liking Mr. Gates, thinking that he's doing a good job. So that's an interesting sort of sideline to that one.
Yeah, we had Larry Johnson on when he was during the confirmation hearings, and I was very skeptical. And Larry was like, you know, this is a stand-up guy. You should be behind him. And I'm like, you know, I think time has proven him right. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Ellen, for the report
from
Washington today. Good talking with you. 866-303-2270, our number, Dick in Ontario, Canada. Hey, Dick, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Tom. How are you?
Nope. Great. What's up?
You know, you are absolutely the best, and I'm sure you've heard this, at explaining the complexities of political discourse and political facts. The interesting thing about that is that sometimes it's very simple things that can also make the point. And last year, Howard Dean came up to Canada and spoke at the Liberal Leadership Convention. And in that convention, he used a phrase that he might have been testing, or you might have heard it before. He said the Republicans and the conservatives in Canada are the me parties, and the Democrats and the liberals in Canada are the we parties. And I thought, wow, that really
hits it. It does.
It's right? And I don't know if you've ever heard that phrase before.
Yeah, I can't say that I've heard it from Howard Dean. I've heard similar sentiments, but that's a really nice, tight little soundbite and really well said. Dick, thank you very much for sharing that with us. George in Selwood, Oregon. Hey, George.
Hey, what earlier was being referred to, if I could capsulize, is corporate feudalism, and that's because we've got an oligarchy running for the rich, by the rich, and I'm just one of the peasant class here who would take umbrage with you on the position of May 15th. Please, if we can be just all of us little powerless people, if we could just see all of us, you know, like being a rock concert where we all held up our lighters.
No, but George, if you don't buy gasoline on May 15th, but you still drive, you're still consuming it.
But
it makes no difference whatsoever.
And I don't disagree with any of your other worthwhile suggestions, and we're all striving for that.
Well, here's an alternative. Don't drive on May 15th.
If that's possible.
Take a bus.
But if that's possible, it doesn't work for everybody. But here's the thing. If we could just see that played out, then you know what? Then it's the first thing that might just put the fear in them. It might.
But it won't. It won't. As long as you're still driving, whether you buy the gas or not, as long as you're still driving, they know you're consuming their product. They just know that you bought a little extra the day before, or you're going to have to buy a little extra the day after. At the end of the month, or at the end of the quarter, which is how they do their accounting, you know, for dividends and things, they made the same amount of money. 57 minutes back.
The Tom Hartman Program. Transforming the world by revitalizing democracy. This is Air America Radio. Program on Air America Radio, where smart people get their news.
Well, frankly, it was predictable. Welcome back to our program, by the way. It was predictable that the male clients of the Washington, D.C. madam, although her name is all over the place, and one of the women who worked for her when she was outed actually committed suicide, that the male clients, ABC News has decided, they're not going to release the names. Andrew Buncombe writing from Washington, D.C. in The Independent, there was an almost audible sigh of relief in parts of America's capital this week after a TV network said it would not reveal the identities of scores of clients of the alleged D.C. madam because they were not well known enough to be newsworthy. Ms. Palfrey, 51, facing federal charges of racketeering and money laundering, etc. Ellen Bravo is with us. She's the author of a new book, Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. EllenBravo.com, the website. Ellen, doesn't this story, in a kind of twisted micro way, without getting into the whole issues, which are, you know, a legion about prostitution, but doesn't this story really illustrate the rampant sexism and hypocrisy which is still endemic to our culture?
Sure. It tells us the rampant sexism. It also the hypocrisy of people who I'm sure are on that list, like Tobias, who preach family values but carry out this kind of behavior in their private lives. But I have to tell you, even if people were completely faithful to their wives, what really concerns me is the number of people in this administration who are screwing women all over the country by the kind of policies they're carrying out. That's the biggest hypocrisy, and that's what I'm most concerned about in my book.
Yeah, it's the economic and power screwing, not the sexual screwing, that is really the issue for women in America right now. I mean, that's
exactly.
And not just women. In fact, one of the things you point out in your book is that it's a virtual oxymoron to say that you are anti-gay and pro-woman, for example.
Absolutely. But, you know, it's also why I say we're not just about smashing the glass ceiling, but redesigning the building from the bottom up to benefit women and men. Because what we need is a different way of doing work, a different way of valuing work in people's families and caregiving time, a different way of valuing women's pay. We're in a situation where the big boys, who are the, what I call the people, the powers that be, the people that control wealth and power in this country, they blame it all on us. You know, they say, well, if there aren't very many women in the good jobs, it's because they don't want to be there. They'd rather be home with their kids. And if women don't make enough money, it's because they don't know how to ask. If they could just ask more, then they'd be okay. We'd have pay equity. Well, the problem isn't that women don't ask for enough. It's that employers don't pay enough. And we can't underscore that point enough. We need to change the rules of the game about how pay gets settled in the first place.
Indeed. And at the same time, we have in the United States this misogyny, for lack of a better word. I mean, this bizarre... It's, you know, Don Imus got fired for his comment, and arguably rightfully so. I don't want to get into that. But at the same time, women seem to be fair game. I mean, you know, Rush Limbaugh, for example, talking about women's rights.
I have long told you, for example, Undeniable Truth of Life number 24, written back in 1987, feminism was established so as to allow unattractive women easier access to the mainstream of society. And even to this day, people poo-poo this and say it's insensitive. How could you possibly say something like that? Well, because I mean it, because I believe there's something to it.
I mean, it's like there's no blowback to that. It's astounding to me.
It is astounding. This is also the guy who said the Dixie Chicks should be slapped, slapped around as if violence against women is a joke. But the truth is, you know, there was a big article in the New York Times yesterday about how much, or the other day anyway, how much shock radio it continues to have outrageously racist and sexist and homophobic comments. Getting rid of Don Imus was a good step, but it was hardly a remedy. The problems are so endemic. But it's not just about language, and this is really important. The realities of so many people's lives who aren't the big boys or their circle are simply discounted, disrespected, underrepresented. These are voices are not, you know, we don't hear them on the airwaves. They're not, their realities aren't celebrated or made known. And that's the real problem in the media. The big boys don't just control the world, they get to describe it, and they get to define what the problems are and therefore what the solutions are. And while we have the illusion that we get to voice our opposition, unless we get to be heard, it really isn't free speech. And so thank goodness for shows like yours that do give voice to, you know, other points of view and what's really happening in the news. But we have so much work to do to revamp the media and who controls it.
Yeah, well, and yet these voices are still out there. Just at the risk of rubbing salt in a wound, as it were, I just think it's so important to just out this stuff. Michael Savage going off about Barbara Walters.
She'd peddle anything for a ratings point. That mental prostitute, Barbara Walters. It sickens me. I think that the woman is vermin. I think she's dirt.
And this, you know, and Diane Sawyer, he goes off on Diane Sawyer.
We have information in this critical time for these people who live in that part of the world. It is so complicated.
You're full of crap. Who do you think you're fooling? You're a liar. And the reason you gave this interview about that interview is because you realize what you have done. You're being told that the people hate your guts. I don't know how this goes on in this country.
You know, calling, and he goes on to call her a slut and whatnot. And, I mean, this... It is almost like it's almost like sexism is acceptable in our society, whereas racism is not, and homophobia is kind of moving into being unacceptable. But there was a time, you know, I remember back in the 70s when there was a time when sexism became unacceptable for a while, when this kind of language would have been roundly condemned right across the board, and then it became kind of semi-fashionable again in the 80s when everybody was, it was kind of the backlash of political correctness.
Yeah, and you know, it's easy for people to say that what we want, we meaning feminists and other people who care about civil rights and social justice, is simply correct language. But this has so much more to do with attitudes about people and, you know, the contributions that they make and what their lives are like. I don't care what anybody calls me. As long as if women could get equal pay and equal opportunity, remove the barriers, you can say whatever you like. This is so
but see,
much
the
more
point is
language.
That as but the point is, as long as that language is endemic to the culture, it becomes one of those tools of oppression. It becomes part of the conventional wisdom.
It's true. This is what I really mean to say. The culture reflects the language. The culture,
yes.
I mean, reflects the reality. The language reflects the undervaluation of women. If women weren't so devalued in our society, there would be no way that that kind of language would have the currency that it does.
Right.
That's what I really mean to say.
We're talking with Ellen Bravo. She's the author of a new book, Taking on the Big Boys, or Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. Her website is ellenbravo.com. Ellen, we have just a little more than about a minute left here. It seems that we need to redefine, or at least define, feminism, because the right has taken and redefined this word, much like they have liberalism. You want to give it a shot?
Sure. You know, in the dictionary, of course, all feminism means is equality in the social, political, and economic sphere between the genders. And I take it one step farther to say it means laws and beliefs and practices that fully value women and work associated with women in order to free the potential of everyone. That means that we would stop paying the people who take care of our young children less than the people who take care of our cars or pets or lawns. It means that we would see caregiving not as women's work but as everybody's responsibility, a more humane way to be. We'd understand that men benefit when women get fair pay and stop being fired for having a sick child. It means that kids would benefit by having access to both their parents' time and love. So that's really what it means.
And I would like to add to that, my dear friend of mine, Ned Halliwell, a psychiatrist and professor at Harvard Med School, once made the observation that testosterone is the most dangerous drug in the world. It's responsible for more wars than any other substance, that more women in politics and in power.
It does, but you know what? The most important thing isn't just having more women in power, but more power in the hands of all women and all other groups who have been treated unjustly and discriminated against. That's what will change us. We don't just want the big boys to be equal numbers of women.
Okay.
What we want is a different way of making decisions.
Yeah, let's drive this from the bottom up. Let's transform our culture, and then all the other stuff follows after.
Absolutely.
Well said. Ellen Bravo, ellenbravo.com, her website, her book, Taking on the Big Boys, Why Feminism is Good for Families, Business, and the Nation. Ellen, thank you for being
with us. Thank you so much. Take care.
Great conversation. 16 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Talk radio for the rest of us. This is Air America Radio.
It's coming through a hole. From those nights in Tiananmen Square, and it's coming from the feel that it ain't exactly real, or it's real but it ain't exactly there. From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay. Democracy's coming to the U.S. It's coming through a crack in the wall, on a visionary flood of alcohol, from the staggering account of the Sermon on the Mount. Dad, don't pretend you understand it all. It's coming from the sands on the dock of the the brave, the bold, the battered, the heart of Chevrolet. Democracy is coming to the USA.
I'm telling you, the pendulum is swinging back. It is absolutely, definitely swinging back toward democracy. And all this sort of misogynist stuff, like Rush Limbaugh with the, wouldn't you too like the Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox?
Ladies, are you fed up with men calling the shots? Are you looking for a new weapon in the war of the sexes? If you need a Hillary Clinton testicle lockbox, you can...
And on it goes. I mean, it's just, this is what we call discourse in America. This is what we call dialogue. Dan in San Diego, California. Hey, Dan, what's on your mind today?
Yeah, about the boycott of oil companies. I agree with you that it doesn't work, but I'm not sure if this would work or not. What if, let's say, like when we saw that the Exxon exec got like $500 million retirement, what if everyone had just boycotted Exxon, sort of a divide and conquer strategy, you know, just boycott Exxon?
When Lee Raymond walked off with his $400 million retirement package.
Yeah, how would that work out, do you think, long term?
You know, Jeff Cohen, the guy who founded Fair and who was Phil Donahue's producer for years, recommended in a column in Common Dreams some year or two ago a boycott, B-U-Y-cott, rather than a boycott. And he pointed out that there is one gasoline company in the United States where a significant percentage of their profits go to pay for schools and housing for low-income people. It's happening for low-income people in South America, but that company is Citgo, which is wholly owned by the Venezuelan government. And so his suggestion was that you go out of your way to buy all your gasoline from Citgo, and that way you're buying no, it's the only oil company from which you're buying no oil from the Middle East. It's the only oil company where the money is actually, to a certain extent, being used for some social, you know, positive social good. That would be a boycott. But I think the larger issue, you know, if we went after one oil company, it's just not enough of us who would do it. There's not a large enough level of outrage, frankly. And what we're going to see, I think, over time, is as the gas companies keep jacking up the prices, and now we've got this incredible increase in prices right now, which is clearly the result of their shutting down refineries. There's an article in today's New York Times about all the refineries that have been shut down. And, it's just maintenance. You know, it's just maintenance. Enron played that game in California. We've seen this movie before, and somehow it always seems to happen around the same time, just before the summer vacation driving season comes. But nonetheless, the reason why cars in Europe get such better gas mileage is because gasoline is $2 or $3 a gallon more in Europe and has been for 30 years. And so the marketplace is adjusted. Now, the problem is that in the United States, if we were to say, okay, we're slapping a $4 gasoline tax on gasoline right now, tomorrow, in theory, that would be a great thing, in as much as it would be a disincentive to use gas, and more people would be using public transportation, there'd be more demand for public transportation and more efficient public transportation and more demand for fuel-efficient cars. And over a period of probably 5 or 10 years, we would be in a position where we no longer needed to import any foreign oil, or at least any oil from any of the OPEC countries. However, over the short term, you'd have independent truckers, you'd have people who drive for a living, that drive their own cars, whatever. People who are living on the edge be facing evictions, being wiped out. So we need a transitional policy here that doesn't hurt the average person and yet does make the transition. And the easy and straightforward ways to do that are things like mandating corporate average fuel efficiency standards, higher fuel efficiency standards for new cars, and building a better infrastructure of public transportation, which conservatives will never do because they don't believe that the government should be in the transportation business or providing transportation. It's not part of their worldview. You leave that to good liberals like Dwight Eisenhower. I mean, it's just real simple. But giving up gas per day, not going to work. Merrill in Long Island. Hey, Merrill.
Taking my call. I have so many comments. I'm not sure where to begin, but I'll start with the gentleman that called about this boycott with the gas. I happen to agree with you on a number of levels. Firstly, I think we need to recognize that people in this country seem to be stuck in the idea that we have some sense of entitlement, that we don't want to be inconvenienced. And the bottom line is everybody has to be inconvenienced a little bit, because nothing is going to change until people recognize that major shifts have to take in the way we view things. And I'm just astounded that people are not recognizing this need.
Yeah, I very well said, Meryl, and totally agree. I keep you know, I've gotten these emails from people whose intellects I respect, who I, you know, I think, you know, these people understand how the world works, and they're saying, oh, don't buy gas for one day, and somehow that's going to change everything. It's not going to change anything. It, you know, it makes people feel good, so it may actually cause us to do less. 27 minutes now.
The Tom Hartman Program. Call Tom at 866-303-2270. This is Air America Radio.
A new day in America. 34 minutes past the hour. May 17th and May 19th. May 17th, I'll be in Denver, Colorado. KKZN, AM 760 is putting on a live show at the Boulder Theater, 9 a.m. to noon. We'll be doing the show live from there. You can get more information on their website, am760.net. And on May 19th, that's May 17th, and on May 19th, KTRC in Santa Fe, New Mexico. We're going to be doing a gig in the afternoon after we get off the air, 2 p.m. I'll be doing the show live from the radio station, but the public event is at the Greer Garson Theater. I'll be doing a song and dance, a bit of a speech or whatever you call it, a presentation, and a book signing. And the doors open at 1:30, and to get tickets, you listen to KTRC, and they will be running promos and liners and whatnot, telling you how you can do that. Today is my birthday, by the way. Just got a note from Louise that when I get home, we're going to sit on our back deck. We live in a houseboat in one of the rivers here that cuts through Portland, about, a, I don't know, maybe 100 feet from the shore. And we've got this crazed goose, Gooselini, who just, you know, goes out. Two years ago, when we first moved in, there was, you know, after we'd only been living here a couple of weeks, and one night I walked out, or one afternoon I walked out of the house, and we've got a floating dock, which is my backyard. It just floats on the back of the house in the river. And we've got some potted plants out there. And I walked out there, and this goose attacks me. I'm like, get back in the house! And Swami Beyond Ananda, Steve Behrman, was visiting, and he says, we should call him Gooselini. We couldn't figure out why this crazed goose was coming after me, after all of us. In fact, when I go out to water the plants, I had to take a broom with me to you know, shoo him off. Turned out his mate was on the back deck of the house next to us, sitting on a nest with a couple of eggs. And the same thing this year. And they hatched, and there's these little yellow fluffy geese. And a couple of days ago, Louise watched as a hawk came down and just snatched one of them and took off. In fact, she called me. It was when I was in New York on Friday. Said, I can't believe what I just saw. We just lost a baby. And so this morning, 3 o'clock in the morning, I go out on the back deck before I come into work and go out for my morning oblations just to stand there under the sky for a little bit. And here's these two geese sitting on the back deck, and one of them is, you know, Gooselini stands up and looks at me, but he doesn't attack me anymore, at least not at 3 in the morning. And Mrs. Gooselini is just, she doesn't stand up because she still has 3 or 4 little yellow fluffy things sitting underneath her that she's protecting. So anyhow, we're going to go hang out with Gooselini and Mrs. Gooselini and, or Gooselina and Mr. Gooselina, well, whatever, and their babies, and have a glass of wine and a piece of gluten-free cake. So should be a fine old time. 1-866-303-2270, our telephone number. If you want to drop into our live chat room, drop by TomHartman.com and click live chat right up at the middle of the top of the page, and it'll get you right in there. Jamie in Columbia, South Carolina, listening on WYC. Hey, Jamie, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I listened to your discussion about biofuels and gasoline, and it seems to me that the idea to boycott gas is unfortunately completely stupid, and so is biofuels. What we need to do is put pressure on our congressmen to investigate these companies, because they're obviously like a monopoly, and if we can get some trust busting investigations going, gas prices would drop to like $1 a gallon in a couple of days. And if people really don't like these gas companies, you're not going to bother them by boycotting. If you really want to get their goat, have them sitting in front of Henry Waxman and trying to explain their accounting practices.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. Sorry, Jamie. It's not even a matter of investigating them. It's a matter of simply going back and saying, in 1982, when Ronald Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act, and we went into this period of a mania of mergers and acquisitions, where big companies got bigger and bigger and bigger, and medium-sized companies all pretty much vanished, and small companies just... I mean, prior to Reagan coming into office, strip malls and shopping centers were filled with local companies owned by local small business people. The corner dry cleaner had been in the same family for three generations. This was called the family business. This was the American dream. Every city block looked different. I remember in the 1960s hitchhiking across the United States from Michigan out to California and back, and every town was different. Now you could drop somebody out of an airplane at 35,000 feet with a parachute, and wherever they land, they'd have no idea where they are, because it's all, hey, there's a McDonald's, there's an Olive Garden, there's a Marriott, not that I'm condemning any of these. It's just that there, because of the ending of the Sherman Act, or the stopping the enforcement, Jimmy Carter was the last president to seriously enforce it, busting up AT&T, which, by the way, increased shareholder equity. It didn't decrease it. It was good for competition. But yeah, we need to seriously say, you know, competition is something that does not happen with laissez-faire capitalism. With absolutely unregulated, unrestrained capitalism, what you eventually get is just a small handful of very, very large companies that behave like a monopoly. And that's certainly what we have in the oil industry. It's absolutely, in fact, what we have in the oil industry. Ed in Portland, Oregon, listening on KPOJ. Hey, Ed, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Listen, you know, listening to all this talk about the 15th, and it, you know, occurs to me that, you know, if people want the 15th to mean something, you know, there's a place for symbolic acts. And the thing is, though, that it needs to be backed up with action, with substance. And what I'm thinking is that, you know, people want to do the boycott for one day. Great. But don't make that the only thing that you do. Get together with some friends and neighbors, 5-10 people, and form a conservation club. Make a list of stuff that you guys can do yourselves. Carpool to work one day a week. Carpool to go shopping, weekend. You know, figure out different things that you can do. Actions like writing your Congress member about raising cafe standards. And then implement one of these things each Tuesday, since 15th falls on Tuesday. Each Tuesday, you know, you and your friends do one of these things. And when you work your way through the list, figure out some more stuff to do and gradually become the change that you want to see in the world.
That's right. And if you want to add a few years to your life and see that change, start walking to the grocery store, the supermarket, if it's possible. Or, I mean, it just amazes me the number of people who will drive five blocks, you know, when they could walk. And,
oh, absolutely.
And
just, I sold my car a couple months ago, and so I've been using public transit, and just about a week ago I built a bicycle for myself. And so, you know, when you start actually getting out in the world and doing stuff in a different way than you've been doing it before, it's amazing how empowering it is, and it's doubly so if you do it with friends, you know, because then you have the reinforcement of you're doing it with people that are doing the same thing that you're doing, and
it's not politically healthy. Thank you very much, Ed. It's not only politically healthy and socially healthy, and physically healthy. It's also psychologically healthy and it's culturally healthy. I mean, it's, you know, right across the board, there's no downside to it. Tim in Tennessee. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hey, happy birthday, Tom. I love your program.
Thank you.
I couldn't bring myself to watch the Republican debates here a few weeks ago or whatever it was. But I wasn't surprised because it was at the Reagan Library. They mentioned Reagan... how many times? 19, 20 times?
35.
Yeah, and they didn't mention Bush but one time. Understand that Reagan's dead? His policies live on, but we're trying to do something about that.
I love it.
I just don't understand why they do this. I mean, is it because that's their new father figure? They can't rely on Bush anymore? I've heard that these right-wing wingers have to have a father figure to kind of lead them along.
Well, it's not just that. It's you know, you have to go back to Eisenhower to find a Republican president that is held in high esteem. I mean, basically, you got Nixon in there, and you've got Bush Sr. was not well thought of. Bush Jr. is a disaster. I mean, even Republicans will tell you he's the worst president in the history of the United States, you know, bar none, and destroying this country. And they really don't like going back to Eisenhower, because Eisenhower was a liberal. And they're not going to go back to Herbert Hoover. He brought us the Republican Great Depression. And so what do they have? They got Reagan. And you know, Reagan talked good. I mean, in the United States, we have this odd synthesis in the office of the presidency. In most countries, or in many countries, the office of head of state and the office of head of government is separated. You have a president and a prime minister, or you have a king or queen and a prime minister in the United Kingdom, for example. So in the United Kingdom, the queen is the head of state. She's the one who represents the country. She doesn't make decisions. She represents the country. The prime minister is the person who takes care of the day-to-day business. In other countries, in Israel, for example, you have a president and a prime minister. The president is the ceremonial guy. The prime minister is the let's-get-stuff-done guy. Here in the United States, we combine those two functions into one office and call it president. And Reagan was very, very good at playing the role of head of state, of being the king. He played that role brilliantly. He was terrible, a disaster, at playing the role of head of government. As head of government, he destroyed this country. He set into motion the forces that have destroyed the American middle class, not to mention all the foreign policy disasters that have followed. But as head of state, and so they look back, you know, fondly, and they like that. Tom in Pittsburgh, just about a minute, Tom, before we've got to take a break. Quick one.
Hi, Tom. I'll be really quick. You know, your earlier callers really hit it on the head. What we need to be doing is getting out and bicycling to the store. The problem is urban planning. We haven't done any. Also, I was just telling you that the malls in my neighborhood have no walking signs. There's no way to cross the street to get to them. They're all blocked off. So even if you could walk there, you couldn't walk around there.
Yeah. I remember. Thanks for the point, Tom. And yes, urban planning needs to make a comeback. We need to elevate that profession. I remember when my dad was first real sick back 5 years ago or so, and he died last summer, and I visited him in the hospital in Lansing, Michigan. This is a neighborhood I used to walk through when I was in junior high school, and at the hospital. And I went out for a walk. I just had to go for a walk, and I probably walked 2 miles around this suburban neighborhood. And this was 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I did not see one pedestrian other than a guy who was out jogging. I mean, that was it. People don't walk anymore. There's cars coming and going. We need to bring back walking. You walk through any city in Europe, any suburb in Europe for that matter, you see people walking. 45 minutes past here.
Exposing the con in conservative. This is the Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio.
Deployment, losing their ability to claim parental rights to their children. And this is a big story yesterday in the press. I saw it over at Huffington Post. It's just, don't get me started. Bert in Long Island. Hey, Bert, what's up?
First thing, I just don't understand why the price of gas goes up during the peak driving season. The price of bottled water doesn't go up. The price of beer doesn't go up during the Super Bowl. I thought the more you sell of a product, the less profit you need to make per unit.
Well, the problem is that water at this point in most countries, in most industrialized countries, there's a relatively unlimited supply of it, or a not severely limited supply of it, and the raw materials for beer, you can say the same thing of. Gasoline is made from oil, and the worldwide demand for oil, as I recall, it's been a few months since I've seen these stats, but my recollection is that the worldwide demand for oil right now runs around 83 or 84 million barrels a day, and the worldwide production is around 84, 85 million barrels per day.
Right.
So we're within a million or two barrels a day, in other words, is the bottom line, of supply colliding with demand. And so, you know, even the smallest disequilibrium causes a problem. But with regard to gasoline, we have in the United States a relatively limited number of refineries. They've gotten bigger and bigger, but they haven't been building new ones, but they have been adding to the ones we have to increase capacity. But what that does is, because there's a small number of refiners, if they decide to pull an Enron on us, like Enron did in California, and shut down a refinery for refurbishing or, whatever. Hey, you know, we've got to paint the thing. If they decide to shut down a refinery, it drives down availability, and it drives down supply, which drives up to...
We've never run out, so the availability has always been basically unlimited for us out here.
Yeah. Well, you know, and you make a good point. And if it could be demonstrated that that's absolutely true, that when price goes up, consumption doesn't actually go down. I mean, the theory is the price goes up 20 or 30 cents. The price goes up 1 or 2%, and so demand goes down 1 or 2%, and so you don't see shortages. And if that theory was tested before Congress and found to be wanting, then you could very easily make the case that, in fact, the price is being manipulated.
Yes.
And I think, in all probability, it is, frankly.
Right. Yeah.
Nobody knows right now.
They use the term supply and demand as if you're going to run out of something, when the term actually means how much the price, the market will bear with the price. They keep jumbling that term up to confuse you, saying that supply and demand is low, when the truth is supply and demand is just how much you'll be willing to pay, is what the economic term is.
No, you're right. It's David Ricardo's notion of the market. It's whatever the market will bear. It's whatever you can get for it. And the reality is that, you know, the oil companies, gas companies can probably jack gas prices up another dollar or two, and eventually, I would say within the next year or two, will. And, you know, it's Dave in San Mateo, California. Hey, Dave.
Hey, Tom. Pleasure talking to you. I just wanted to echo your sentiments about it's frivolous to not drive one day. It's equivalent of somebody going on a diet, eating 10 donuts one day and then the next, and then coming back, eat 10 the next day. If everybody was to, buy a bike on May 15th instead of not drive, it would be better. And if you really wanted to affect the price of gas, and everybody can do this, just slow down. Drive 55 miles an hour instead of 65 or 70, and you will see the price of gas drop very fast.
Yeah, and make sure your tires are inflated. When you see a red light coming up, slow down more slowly, more gradually as you go up to it. I mean, it's just simple. You know, my dad, when I was a kid, when I was learning how to drive, he said, always accelerate as if there's a raw egg between your foot and the gas pedal. It's easier on the car. Your car will last longer. You'll use a lot less gas. And it's, I mean, there's just a lot of very simple things that you can do short of going out and buying a Prius. Good point, Dave. Thank you. Allison in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Allison.
Hi. I was calling. I think that the boycott is possibly a good idea, but a one-time event is not going to have an impact, as you were saying. And I wanted to propose, I lived in Germany in the 70s when there were gas shortages, and the government implemented a no-drive Sunday. And it was great. It helped a lot. And I don't know why we don't do a day where it's easier for people not to drive, say Saturday and Sunday or Sunday, and we do it as an ongoing event.
Yeah, well, to a certain extent, this gets, you know, if we were to do it institutionally, this gets back to the fact that we have an absolute and utter failure of planning, urban and suburban planning in the United States. There are neighborhoods that have no sidewalks. There are neighborhoods you can't get in and out of without a car.
Right.
And even in some urban areas, you know, that's the case. And so, you know, there's that. But I think that, you know, if if the people who are promoting this don't buy gas on May 15th had instead simply said, don't drive your car on May 15th,
right.
Then I'd say, you know, okay, it's a good step, and it's going to wake people up, and it's going to cause some people to change their behavior. But mm-hmm. the problem is the don't buy gas thing, people, you know, they buy their gas the day before, and they say, on May 15th, I'll buy no gas, and they feel like they've done something. And I think that that's, frankly, a bad thing, because people feel like they've done something, then they don't go out and do something that's really important, because there's so much that can be done. Tomorrow I'll be challenging conservative Naftali Ben-David on his book, The Thumpin', How Rahm Emanuel and the Democrats Learned to Be Ruthless and Ended the Republican Revolution. Rahm Emanuel? I thought it was the progressives. Hey, don't forget, my friends, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
Tom Hartman Program on Air America Radio. For exclusive Tom Hartman archives and more information, visit us online at airamericaradio.com.